Looking back at the month of May. COVID-19 has, of course, dominated the news in Maine this past month. The state has now tripled its testing capacity. We saw more outbreaks, including at a memory care facility in Cumberland County. But Maine's hospitals have not been overwhelmed. There are still critical care beds and ventilators available. And parts of the economy have started to reopen, from doctor's offices to hair salons. I'm Jennifer Rooks. There are those who believe the state is reopening too quickly and others too slowly, especially some restaurant owners in southern Maine. Today on Maine Calling, we will reflect on this extraordinary month with our panel of editorial page editors. What's on your mind? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, it is time for our Month in Review show. My guests are Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, who's editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Welcome back to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
It's funny, sometimes it seems like no time has passed since I've talked to you all last, but boy, it seems like a long time has passed since I've talked to all of you. And as always, we want to hear from you and the audience. Which stories in this past month stood out to you? Is there anything that you're talking about, not at the water cooler, because you're probably not going to work, but with your neighbors or your family members? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or as always, call 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Everyone, I want to get to the reopening in just a minute, but first I want to talk about how COVID-19 has affected Maine. The good news is that Maine's hospitals have not been overwhelmed. Remember when we were talking about overflow emergency treatment centers that were planned for the civic centers in Portland and Bangor, the National Guard getting ready to make those happen? Those have not been needed. On the other hand, today's numbers are out. Now, 85 Maine people are known to have died of COVID-19, 270 right now in the hospital. It remains a big deal, Susan.
It absolutely does. And the hospitalizations, very interesting. You know, as you say, big fear that our healthcare system would be overrun. So I think state agencies and others were prudent to build up hospital capacity, emergency capacity. And thankfully, it wasn't needed, in part because people stayed home and did things to flatten the curve, as we say. But it's going to be really longstanding challenge for hospitals because they put off procedures, routine, what we call, elective, but sometimes that includes cancer treatments and other life-saving treatments. And so hospitals are losing a lot of money because they're not providing type of treatment that they make money on. And a lot of hospitals have let staff go. We've had layoffs in Maine and a couple hot rural hospitals teetering on the brink financially. So how do hospitals continue to provide care for COVID-19 patients, be prepared for a surge in more patients, while at the same time trying to get back to business as usual so that they can stay open financially? So a lot of pressures that they're facing and going to continue to face in coming months and probably years.
That's right. I mean, a lot of rural hospitals already on the brink before COVID-19.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ben, as you look at the numbers of hospitalizations, the number of deaths, what are you and comparing it to what we had predicted, or not we, but what experts had predicted, what goes through your mind?
Well, like Susan said, we did the first job. We did the first phase. We shut things down. While we could get a handle on what this virus is and how it works and learning about how to control it and making sure that our hospitals didn't get overrun. Now we're kind of transitioning into this other phase. Too early if you ask the public health experts, not fast enough if you ask a lot of the business owners. So we're kind of in this transition phase, and then and the worrying part, I think, for me is that you know, the cases start to come in. They're not huge numbers of cases, but they're high, and they're higher than they were a couple weeks ago. And they're just kind of steady coming along. And that's kind of happening across the country at a time when I think we hoped that we would have kind of a deeper valley for this. Everybody's worried about the fall, but we thought we might have a little deeper valley in the summer. And we haven't, we're not approaching that. And we don't know if that's because, you know, that's because we didn't shut down enough, or, you know, or we're just missing something, not doing something right. But it's a little, it's nice that we got past this phase without the worst case scenarios coming true. And that's, you know, that's because everybody, a lot of people did what they were supposed to do, but we're also not quite to where we should have been, at this point. And, at the same time, people are getting a little bit complacent about it. And, that's kind of worrisome.
Mm-hmm. Craig?
Yeah, I would like to, you know, agree with Ben and Susan both. But, you know, I think the number that really hasn't changed much at all is the number of people in ICU beds. And we have this impression that there was, like, a lot of concern in early April. And, you know, people were very worried about the virus. And then as the month went on, cases seemed to start to decline, and people seemed more anxious to get out and go back to normal. But if you look at the numbers of people in ICU beds, they've been stable to climbing the whole time, and that's the kind of you know, baseline that you don't want to have if there is like a big outbreak. But you know, the other thing is that the you know, we've just been through a unprecedented public health mobilization, unlike anything that any of us have ever seen. And that's got to have had some effect. I mean, the that wasn't implemented to avoid 85 deaths and 2,000 cases. It was to, you know, avoid hundreds of deaths.
And yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a weird counterfactual, because some people will look at these numbers and say, "Oh, we would have been fine. We didn't need to do anything." But for that to be true, then all this you know, the sacrifices everybody's been making would have had no effect at all, which it seems hard to believe.
Sure, and it's always very hard to know what would have happened. I want to turn to the phased reopening of Maine business and of Maine. This seems to be the really the big story of the month in May. And Governor Mills is taking a lot of heat this week for delaying the reopening of indoor dining and restaurants in three Maine counties. That was supposed to happen on Monday, and now will not. She's also postponed the reopening of nail salons and some other businesses. Republicans are making hay of this. They're crying foul. They're holding protests. I was talking with Maine Public State House reporter Steve Missler this morning about the decisions the governor has to make. And he pointed out there is absolutely no winning for her in this situation. None. Politically perilous in every way. Ben, do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this event has kind of dropped a lot of responsibility on her. And in a way that's, I hate to use this word again, but unprecedented. And she's trying to navigate through it. And she's, you know, started with this kind of one size fits all approach, I think with the idea of altering it as it went. And that's what she's done, as, you know, businesses have come forward in different sectors and different regions and made their case for why they should open. And she's being careful. And so you can, you know, you can quibble with a lot of these like individual decisions and, you know, why is this open and this not open? And I understand the frustration of business owners who are just trying to plan. But, you know, there's just no way to, as I said before, you know, a lot of people think we're coming out of this too fast. A lot of people think we're coming out of it too slowly. And none of us really know for sure. It's easy to kind of spout off when you don't have to make those decisions that that involve people's livelihoods and their lives. But that's what's happening right now. So, you know, while I can certainly find some things to criticize the governor for during this time, I don't think we can forget how difficult this task is and how it's just full of uncertainty.
Yeah. Susan, I'm wondering, the Bangor Daily News covers a lot of Maine that has allowed restaurants to reopen. We did a Maine calling program the day that many were allowed to reopen, and some made the choice to do so and some made the choice not to do so. What is the sense in the counties where this has been allowed now for a while? How many restaurants are opening their doors to indoor seating, and how is it going for them?
I mean, it's hard to know. It's only been a little over, well, almost 2 weeks since the 18th. But as you said, it's a mix. Some were very eager to open and did so right away. Some, even though they're allowed to, still have not. A lot of restaurants, certainly along the coast, are still waiting to see what happens with the tourist season. You know, are their customers going to come here, especially in the summer? A lot of these restaurants rely on people from out of state. And certainly the 14-day quarantine remains very controversial. You know, I think Ben put it very well. The governor's doing the best she can with the information that she has, which is, you know, changing fairly rapidly. You know, her responsibility is to protect the safety of all Mainers, and that means their health, physical health, their economic health as well. So it's a very challenging balance that she's trying to meet, and not everyone is going to be happy with her decisions. And a lot of folks, according to polling, are very supportive of where she is. And as Ben mentioned, a lot of people worried that we're moving a little too quickly. So businesses doing the best they can, making decisions, but ultimately it's up to the customers and whether the customers are going to show up or not. I mean, I have to say from personal experience, you know, being kind of holed up in the Bangor area, we went to Washington County over the weekend, and it was a little jarring to see a lot of people going in and out of restaurants with no masks and not really social distancing. So, you know, there's still reasons to be nervous. At the same time, you understand people want to get back to life and businesses want to begin making money again, but still a very difficult situation with so many unknowns, and things are going to continue to change. Some businesses will probably get open more quickly than the governor initially said. Others will be slower than was in the original plan. But I think the frustration for the businesses in the southern Maine counties, you know, it's a question of timing. What, is there any possibility that they could have been given a little more notice since they were planning to open, especially restaurants? You know, had to buy food, get some staff back, and then to be told in less than a week that they weren't going to reopen. I understand that that presents some special hardship because of the what they perceive as a short amount of time to, again, change their plans.
Sure, and I was going to ask you about that, Greg. The Portland Press-Herald's Meredith Goad had a really really in-depth story about the response from restaurant owners when this decision was made. And I saw it on my social media feed. People who otherwise are pretty supportive of Governor Mills, very frustrated by this one change.
Yeah, you know, I saw some comments from Democrats in the legislature who felt, you know, speaking up for their constituents, who felt that they should have gotten more notice. But you know, I think, you know, we use this phrase, the new normal, all the time, and this might be the new normal, that there are going to be more shocks, there are going to be delays, and everything's not going to be smooth going forward. You can't just say June 1st eating in restaurants is safe. You know, she said when she announced that June 1st date, she said they'll be watching three major metrics, the flu-like infections, new COVID cases, and hospitalizations. And in the counties that are not going to have their restaurants open on Monday, you saw increases in two of those categories. If the facts on the ground tell you that there's more cases with the restaurants closed, it doesn't make sense to open them up right away. And it's very frustrating for the business people. I totally respect where they're what they're feeling, and especially since, you know, like Susan said, they invested in imperishables, and they're not going to have the customers, and it sends a confusing message. But I think all of us are going to have to get used to at least a period where the future is kind of unknowable and unpredictable.
Ben Bragdon, Susan mentioned that she was in Washington County. You saw a lot of people not wearing masks. Masks or face coverings has gone on to represent something so much more than just a piece of cloth for so much, not just in Maine and America. We've heard the horrible stories about, you know, security guards being shot for asking someone to wear a mask. We also know that some people, people who are deaf, depend on lip reading to be able to, you know, and wearing a mask is something that's something that culturally up until this point is something, you know, we don't want. Criminals break into convenience stores with masks on. What do you, from your vantage point, there in the center of the state, where what are you seeing and what do you think this whole debate over masks represents?
Well, you know, it went right from, it kind of skipped being a public health discussion and went right to part of the culture war, which doesn't help anything. It became a symbol of where you stand politically. And then also means that, you know, if you're someone who wants everyone to wear a mask and you see someone without one, or the other way around, you instantly make assumptions about that person and their political leanings. And, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame because, you know, more and more masks are turning out to be maybe our best tool against this. And it's funny because I remember the first thing I wrote about this was, you know, don't hoard masks because, you know, the experts say they don't really help you unless they're fitted. And then, here we are, you know, 2 months later saying everybody needs to get a mask. It's certainly a huge change. It's something we've seen in Asian countries who have dealt with, you know, airborne viruses and for a while. And it takes a lot of getting used to. Like the cues you take socially, you know, the way we interact, just the physical feeling of it. The first time, a couple of times I went into the grocery store with it, I felt very kind of removed from everybody and a little like, you know, it feels strange. You do. You feel like a robber going into a bank. And it's a strange thing. And we have to figure out how to interact that with masks and as a population that needs to wear masks. You know, if you're saying everyone needs to wear masks, part of that has a shaming component to it. Whereas, you know, you go to a place and everyone has a mask on, you don't. There needs to be some sort of social pressure to get that done. We don't want laws to say that. But on the other hand, you don't want to, you know, scream at people or certainly not attack them physically because they don't have a mask that moment. So it's a, like Greg said, it's a new normal, a lot of uncertain things, a lot of things that require adjusting. And it's, at a time when we're not really getting along in this country, that's going to be a tough thing to do.
We're going to take a quick break. We are talking about the month in review, the news in Maine, all related to COVID-19, or pretty much all of it. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Mark Cuban. He's an entertainment mogul, an NBA owner, and a billionaire, but his economic program is definitely populist.
You create jobs that people have confidence they'll be able to retain. This has to be a bottom-up solution, not a top-down or trickle-down solution.
Mark Cuban, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 and again Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Valerie Kondo's field eventually became a champion gymnastics coach. But before that,
I was pathetic, horrible,
okay.
Trying to be somebody else.
Aw, don't be so hard.
No, I was bad.
I'm Manoush Zomorodi. The reinvention of cities, songs, even ourselves. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And that's coming up tomorrow afternoon at 1 and again Wednesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the top news stories in Maine from the month of May. Our panel of editorial page editors is with us. Greg Kesich is with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now, Stephen Porter. He is the Maine editor for Seacoast Online and editor of the York County Coast Star. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jennifer.
What has been the response in your part of the world to the coronavirus crisis? You're a little bit different because you're so close to the rest of New England.
Absolutely. So we've been watching as each community in our coverage area, really up and down the coast, has taken this public health threat seriously and taken decisive action, sometimes controversial actions, to limit the spread of this virus. Even when we talked with tourist-oriented business owners here, I've been really impressed by how understanding they have been, even in the face of some of those controversial decisions. They've taken steps to keep customers separated and keep the communities here safe. I think one noteworthy item, especially in recent weeks, this past week especially, is the growing sense of restlessness, though, especially after Governor Mills postponed the reopening of dine-in restaurant services. We've actually got a reporter on the ground right now in Wells where some local business owners are speaking out about that.
All right. How has Seacoast Online or the Seacoast Media Group covered the pandemic?
So our newsroom straddles the state line with New Hampshire, so it's been interesting to listen as our journalists have participated remotely in regular calls, not only with Governor Mills, but also with Governor Sununu. Of course, this is not just about the state government's responses. There's also been local governments, business leaders, school leaders, really every local organization you can imagine. All of those stories that we would normally tell about education or business or anything really has become a COVID-19 story. So we've been pooling our resources across the group to try and make sure that we're covering those the best that we can.
Before we let you go, Stephen, I want to ask our other editorial page editors if they have any questions for you from their vantage points in the state. Susan, Bren, Greg?
Stephen, how is New Hampshire dealing with out-of-state tourists?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I know that there has been some concern about out-of-staters, so to speak, in New Hampshire as well, but I don't know that it's been as pronounced as what we've seen in Maine, York, and Cumberland counties especially.
Mm-hmm. Steve, do you know there's a lot of people in Maine that work in New Hampshire and vice versa? With the 14-day quarantine in Maine, I assume that people in that situation are pretty much ignoring that guidance.
Well, it's my understanding that for employment that's deemed essential, I don't think that that 14-day requirement would necessarily apply in the way that it would if you're just going to go take a stroll on the beach in York, for example.
Is what's considered essential the same in both states?
I know that there's some difference. I think that it's largely similar, but there are some minor differences because obviously those policies have been set by each state government.
Well, I wanted just
Stephen,
go ahead, Ben.
Sorry, I was just wondering if you could see any daylight between Maine's response and New Hampshire's response, or how the people in the state themselves feeling towards it. It's just, New Hampshire's a little close to Massachusetts and to that huge cluster, whereas parts of Maine are almost in another time zone. So, have noticed a difference there?
I think that, one key difference is probably the timelines for opening certain things. There's been some caution, especially with when to reopen beaches. In New Hampshire, I think that it's been a little bit delayed compared to where some of the areas in Maine have been. There are other areas, but that's one key area where I think that you can see some slight differences where the overall objectives are the same and some of the levers that state government is pulling are the same, but the timelines differ a bit. Mm.
Yeah.
Stephen, any final thoughts?
I think, you know, I would just be remiss if I didn't express gratitude for our readers. Like other publications in Maine and elsewhere, we've lowered the paywall for our COVID-19 stories and had a really great response from our readers. So I just want to express appreciation for everyone who has subscribed and shared our work online.
Yeah, well, Stephen, thank you for giving us a call today and taking part in the conversation. That's Stephen Porter. He's the Maine editor for Seacoast Online and editor of the York County Coast Star. Appreciate your joining us today. Before the break, we were talking a little about face coverings and masks, and I had to go to the break because of timing. But Susan Young, what are your thoughts about where we are in terms of what it means in society to be wearing a mask or not wearing a mask?
Well, it's interesting. I think, as Ben mentioned, how quickly this became part of the culture wars, but not just about wearing the mask, but also about the guidance around wearing a mask. As I think it was Greg mentioned early on, the guidance was not to wear masks, in part because certainly the medical grade masks were in short supply and we didn't want civilians wearing them. But also, you know, the information about coronavirus is changing so quickly. And as we learn more, the guidance changes. But for a lot of people, they're pointing to the CDC and others saying, see, initially they told us not to wear masks, and now they're telling us to wear masks. So they don't even know what they're talking about. So they've used the mask guidance as a way to discredit any information about coronavirus, even if it comes from health experts. And you know, instead of seeing uncertainty as just inherent in this, obviously it's called a novel virus because we've never seen it before. We don't know. There's so much we need to learn. And that means that guidance and regulations and the procedures for treating people who have the illness are going to continually change. And it's just unfortunate that for some people that just undermines the trust in expertise in government altogether because the message changes. Therefore, any message is suspect. So that's just another layer of this disagreement about wearing a mask and whether it makes you, as some people say, you know, a sheep that's just following the government into, you know, tyranny, or is it, as we believe, a public health thing to do, not so much to protect yourself, but to protect other people because so many carriers of coronavirus are asymptomatic. So it's just interesting on how many different levels masks have come to symbolize the disagreements that we have amongst each other with our government, with experts. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah, we're going to go to Jill, who's calling from Rockland and has been hold for a long time. Hi, Jill. Go ahead. Jill, are you still there? I hope so.
Hi. Yes, I am. Hello.
Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call today. I'm glad I made it through. Yes, I am calling because I had this, just felt more and more necessary to become engaged, and more so. And late last year, I attended this event, and it was put on by this group called the Mainers for Accountable Leadership. And I thought it was going to be great and perfect. And I really enjoyed the first like hour or so. And this woman, Marie, really was passionate. And I thought, okay, I'm learning how to do this. And then she started talking about, well, just that there's letters to the editors and how there are these groups out there that are making this. And she said this big, big money, like Planned Parenthood and Mainers People's Alliance. And those were two of them. And she mentioned a couple others and that these are paid. And it really took me aback because I consider myself someone who wants to be really informed, especially now, especially in these times. There's so much information.
So, Jill, just to be clear, Jill, just to be clear, she's alleging that they're paying to have their letters published in the papers?
Yeah, she said it right at the event. And I was stunned because I I trust I trust the news from you guys. I read your outlets, and I like to be informed. And I just was so shocked, and it didn't sit well with me. And you mentioned, like, what have we been talking about and what's been on our minds? And I've been talking about it with my friends, and I'm really concerned about it. So what is the line between activism and newspapers these days? And how do you maintain it? How do you guys do that for us?
Sure, Jill. You've got the right people to talk to. Greg, I'm going to take this to you. You do not accept money to print an article, a letter in the paper.
I hope that you misunderstood Marie, or you know, I'll have to call her and make sure that that's not what she thinks, because no, we don't take, people do not pay to get letters to the editor in, and organizations don't pay to get letters to the editor in, and we don't pay people to write them. I think what she might have been saying is that sometimes organizations will use paid staff to help people write letters in different kinds of campaigns, public influence campaigns. And we do keep an eye out for what we call AstroTurf, which is an organization pretending to be grassroots. I'm sorry, it takes so long to say that, but they're trying to look like a grassroots thing, but it's really an organized effort. And we do try to weed those out if we can. It's not always possible to know. But no, I can assure you that nobody pays to get a letter of the editor in, and we don't pay anybody to write them.
And Greg,
we don't write them ourselves either, by the way, which is another misunderstanding some people have.
And Greg, on prior shows, you've talked to me about when you've called people that have sent you a letter. There's a bit of a vetting process.
We call them up and say, did you write the letter? And there's a little bit of we're a little bit vulnerable to somebody lying to us. I shouldn't probably say that. Never mind. I didn't say that. but, you know, if somebody is really going to, you know, really, really wants to lie to get their letter to the editor in, they might be able to get away with it. But the whole point is that we do verify the identity as best we can. And if the person is like a leader in a group or a member of an elected official, we try to note that in the signature so that to show that they have some standing or some connection to the issue. But you know, we do take what steps we can to vet the letters. And when you look at what happens on the internet, we're kind of unique in that respect. People post anonymously on social media all the time.
Yeah, and Susan, this is sort of basic ethics for someone in your position, right?
Right. I mean, we do the things that Greg has mentioned, and absolutely, we don't pay for letters, nor are we paid to run them. I mean, there are certainly situations where activist groups encourage and help people to write letters. And so when we call and verify, say, did you write the letter? And the person says yes, and we're suspicious that they had help, you know, there's not a lot we can do about that. As Greg said, that's a vulnerability. And we certainly know that that's going on, and that campaigns recruit people. And it's an unfortunate aspect of the work we do. But to Greg's point, you know, we both talked about the verification we go through. What not only do readers have to put their actual name, they have to put a hometown, versus what's on the web where, you know, it can be your next door neighbor or it could be a non-existent bot from who knows where. So, you know, we're certainly not the end all and be all, but we do put a lot of effort into verifying the information that we print and share with our readers and our subscribers.
Great. We're going to go to Lee, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Hi. This is a great thoughtful analysis. I don't think we're going to get on TV broadcasts. I'm a Passport member of Maine Public, a subscriber to BBN, and also a print subscriber to Kennebec Journal. But just thank you, because this is good from the print and the radio. I wanted to talk about the campaigns, because they're polarizing, the same like sort of AstroTurf that there's, you know, assaulting, you know, encouraging people to write. There's a war on the media right now, and I feel like that same campaign or the elements of that war on the media are also propelling these angry mobs brandishing weapons to go and, you know, hit on state houses of where there are Democratic governors. You saw what happened in, with Governor Beshear. Governor Mills has taken a lot of criticism. Yes, there is economic frustration. They're trying to reopen. I get my question boils down to this. If Governor Mills was Republican with the same policies and the same restrictions and acting upon the same information, do you think that this that the campaigns that have been going on, the protests at the State House, would be carried out to such an extent?
Yeah, like, that's a good question. Yeah, we could have asked Stephen from the York County Co-Star about Sununu. But Ben, what are you seeing with Republican governors? I know you track politics across the country. Republican governors who have imposed restrictions, are they also seeing the same kind of protests?
Not as much. And sometimes they're kind of indirected. I know in like Ohio, where the governor is a Republican, Mike DeWine, he's followed a lot of the same track as Janet Mills has. He's been very public health oriented, and you know, a lot of the protests of that focus more on his public health commissioner, who is a woman, the public health person in there that was a Democrat. I can't really remember the specifics, but. Certainly there's an aspect to this, if not, you know, grassroots. A lot of the protests in the Midwest all came from one local group there that kind of just cut and pasted their stuff into each state, and through Facebook got people riled up. It's an interesting question. I mean, the question is also, would she be doing the same thing if she was a Republican? You see Republicans in states like Florida and Georgia move a little bit faster. My biggest point to make here is that the difference between the fastest and the slowest state is not that wide. And so a lot of these protests are kind of like, you know, open up a few weeks faster than you are. And it kind of loses me at that point, because, you know, to say that we never should have shut down is ridiculous. So the question then becomes, how severely do you do it, and how quickly do you reopen? And there's a wide range of acceptable opinion on that, I think. And certainly in Maine, the fact that if a Democratic governor and a Democrat legislature doesn't give the Republicans a whole lot of power in this, and so you know, it can lead them to kind of lash out in this way, because that's what they have in their toolbox right now.
Lee, thanks for your call. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of our discussion of the news of May. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. And Alt-E Store, providing solar power, battery backup equipment, and advice to solar installers and do-it-yourselfers. Alt-E-Store.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The 10th National Spelling Bee was held at the National Museum in Washington, D.C. on May 29, 1934. The winner was 8th grader Sarah Wilson of Gray. Sponsored by the Portland Evening Express, Sarah correctly spelled the word brethren. Wilson had also competed in the finals the prior year. She has been the only National Spelling Bee winner from Maine. She graduated from the Pennell Institute in Gray in 1938 and worked in Washington, D.C. as an attorney for the Internal Revenue Service for 41 years.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
It's been just 4 months since the first reported case of coronavirus in the U.S. Today, we lead the world with more than 1.7 million infections.
It's been humbling, tragic, and terrifying looking at these numbers. And we need to remain vigilant as we go forward.
What we know and don't know about the path forward this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about the leading news stories from the past month. My guests are our usual suspects. We're happy to have Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal, and Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald. If you'd like to join the conversation, call quickly 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. An email here from Jennifer. Everyone I know is talking about the video of George Floyd's murder, surrounded by police officers, one of whom was doing the killing. The demonstration in downtown Belfast at noon was received well by passersby. Susan Young, my phone has just let me know that that officer is now in custody. There's a protest this afternoon in Portland, even though this has happened a long way away in Minnesota. It hits awfully close to home for many people.
It does. It's just the question we all have is, again, you know, this is happening again. Will anything change? Will there be different policies? Will people somehow miraculously become more tolerant of one another? Will people stop calling the police because Black people are barbecuing or using a swimming pool or walking and birdwatching in Central Park? I mean, clearly there's institutional things that need to change among police forces and others, but also amongst all of us to be better, more tolerant citizens. And just seeing, you know, the fires and the anger in Minneapolis and in Louisville, you have to ask, is this a turning point? I mean, I was a little kid in 1968, very little kid, so I don't know if there are any echoes to that time, but there's a sense that maybe, and it's a faint maybe, things will be different this time and we'll come away from these instances with a better understanding, with different policies, and maybe the outcome will be different. It's very rare for police officers to be charged in situations like this, and when they are, they're usually acquitted. So, you know, the country will kind of wait with bated breath to see what happens with the officer in Minneapolis. But, you know, that's just, to me, the big question is, will anything be different after all of this?
And Greg, in Portland, the Portland Police Department issued what it called an open letter to the Portland community about this, saying that the Portland Police Department has policies and strategies in place in order to prevent such a tragedy from happening here. Highly unusual to have a letter from the police department address something that has happened somewhere else. Greg? Shoot, now we've lost Greg. Oh, man. Everything was going so well. There you go. Go ahead.
Hello?
Okay. Greg, can we hear you?
Am I back?
Yeah, you are. Yeah. Go ahead.
This is good radio, huh? You know, I think an important historical precedent is that all the big riots of the 1960s kicked off by police misconduct. You know, Watts, Newark, Detroit, and this is a part of our history that that gets forgotten because there's so much focus on the you know, the terrifying atmosphere of a riot, but the circumstances behind it are something that we carry with us to this day. And you know, the question is, Portland police have been proactive before. There were a number of, I think it was in 2016 or 17, a number of police shootings, deaths by police around the country. And then the Portland Police Chief Mike Soschuk held a number of community forums and was very, you know, proactive about it. So I'm not surprised to see that department getting ahead of things. But it is a problem that is just woven into our society. And even in a place like Maine, it's something that we have to think about because it is, you know, it's so much part of how people live.
Ben, I'm hesitant to go to you. Are you there? Do you want to comment on this?
I'm here. Yeah, I mean, it's an awful situation. I won't say much except to say that the riots that were happening are not the problem. The problem is the conditions that caused them. And until we white Americans take into consideration the circumstances under which a lot of Black Americans live and their relationship with the police and how it's so different than what I grew up with and what most other white people grew up with, that we can't even understand some of these actions sometimes. And that's what has to change. That's what has to change, I think. And it's not going to be easy, but, you know, I woke up this morning and saw what was going on. And this could all, who knows where, if we'll be talking about this in a month, but it certainly seems like maybe a turning point, maybe a firing off point. I don't know how we're going to handle it and how our leaders are going to handle it, but it does feel like we're living in a moment of history right now.
All right, we're going to go to Tom, who's calling from Freeport. Hi, Tom, go ahead.
Hi, how are you? I don't know if it was mentioned before or not, but Dr. Shah indicated a couple of weeks ago that there'd be a big increase in testing on the disease, and whether or not that skewed the positives to a higher number, I don't know, but I just didn't think that had been mentioned and thought I'd bring it up to the conversation.
Yeah, Tom, thank you for bringing that up. And it is true that when the numbers have been going up, right, Susan, there has been always that qualifier that these numbers are going up, but that was expected because we're doing more testing.
Right, absolutely. I mean, as I think Dr. Shah said, when you go looking for something, you find it.
But
the number... that shouldn't affect the numbers of people in ICUs. People who were sick enough to be in an ICU would have been whether there was testing or not. So I think when you look at those numbers, you can sort of see that there's been a steady number of cases of very sick people.
Right. Although the numbers have gone up of the number of people who have tested positive, there has not been a big spike in the number of people in ICUs right now. And that's one of the measures. Another measure that I've heard is the positive to negative ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're all learning.
The percentage of people that test positive out of the total that are tested. And that hasn't changed, I don't believe, significantly. It fluctuates.
We're all learning so much every day. Tom, thank you for your call. And it's going to be our last call this hour. And as always, thank you to our regular panel of newspaper editorial page editors. We really appreciate you all. Susan Young, the editorial page editor of the Bangor Daily News. Ben Bragdon, the editorial page editor of the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. And Greg Kessich, the editorial page editor of the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Lucy Suchak ran the board today, and today's Maine Calling program will be rebroadcast again tonight at 7 o'clock. You can always find past editions of the program, as well as links and resources, at mainecalling.org. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandrow. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. In just a few minutes, Maine Public Radio will air the latest briefing from CDC Director Nirav Shah. You can also watch the briefing on Maine Public Television or at the Maine Public website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.